previously on We Live Here.
So for those of you who haven't been to a Jewish sleepaway camp before, it's very touchy-feely. So think constant cuddle puddles, hammock sharing, cabin circles every night, journal circles till 1 in the morning.
For me, gospel helped me to continue and to keep going. Gospel is what is the reason that I'm still here.
We'd be walking through the hallways freshman year, and she'd be like, hey guys, this girl's name's not pronounced Donna, it's Sadna, you better get it right.
We threw confetti at each other, we even threw confetti at our moms. That was the best day ever.
Hey, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
And we're going to start the show by taking a little detour from housing, just a little one, and take you back in time to 2011. And that's when, and this is going to sound kind of gross, because it was, raw sewage began leaking into rivers and streams, even into people's basements.
Folks who live in St. Louis for a while know this story well. It was, to put it mildly, a mess.
Yes. in the late summer of that year, the Metropolitan St. Louis Sewer District, or MSD, who was ultimately responsible for this sewage getting into places where it shouldn't go, reached a huge agreement with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
And full disclosure, MSD is a sponsor of We Live Here, but that has no influence over this content.
Yes. So at any rate, under the agreement with the EPA, MSD had to make some big upgrades to the tune of $4.7 billion, with a B, dollars.
But as the work got underway, Adolphus Pruitt, president of the NAACP in St. Louis, started hearing complaints.
Minority contractors and other folks saying they were not getting a fair share of the business that was being done out in MSD. So we began to advocate to change the way MSD was doing business. That led to the discussion about them doing a disparity study.
And once that report was finished, there were a lot of ideas floating around about how MSD could go about changing the way it does business. But Pruitt wanted to use a technique he had heard about from other parts of the country.
It's called a community benefits agreement.
A community benefits agreement basically is a understanding between a, in some cases, in most cases, a private developer and citizens or organizations of the community who want to see more come out of a project than what normally you can expect.
Pruitt's push worked, and the NAACP, with 9 other organizations, including the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, the National Society of Black Engineers, and Metro St. Louis Coalition for Inclusion and Equity, signed on to the CBA with MSD. The deal had some teeth.
It provides for binding arbitration and a disagreement, and it also provides for injunctive relief, where if we felt that they were in breach, we can get them notice of a breach, and if they don't fix the breach, it provides that we can go into the circuit courts.
Pruitt says that carrot and stick approach to the CBA came in handy when he and others began to hear new complaints from minority and women contractors.
The numbers as relates to the number of minority workers and the work hours being attained by minorities and women, we didn't think it was sufficient. We didn't believe that the MSD was doing everything it could do. And we wound up putting together some procedures, some practices, some tracking, you know, all sort of things. MSD worked, we sat around the table for almost more than a year, hours of peeling back the onion and looking at how we do this, both how we do it as advocates and how MSD does it as a public operating entity. And we think that at the end we came out with something where I think it's safe to say that MSD and us as a team have created something that is very special and is really doing a significant job and doing it better than anybody, not only in the region, not only in the state. But if we were to put it up against outcomes in the country, we would be in the top 10.
Fast forward a couple of years, and Pruitt, who previously worked in real estate and business development, sees a new opportunity in Midtown St. Louis.
The Foundry is under development there
at
Spring and Forest Park.
Yeah,
the Armory under redevelopment. You got a new hotel. And you have all these apartments being redeveloped in that area. So you had a lot of synergy. Then you got the brand new hospital.
The new construction is being guided and promoted by the St. Louis Midtown Redevelopment Corporation. Its shareholders are St. Louis University and SSM Health.
And with a little help from City Hall, and after months of negotiations, Pruitt reached a similar deal to the one he had with MSD with the new St. Louis Midtown Redevelopment Corporation.
It includes tracking the number of women and minority-owned businesses, and it funds a city position to monitor the agreement and make sure goals are met.
And tucked inside its large footprint are a couple of neighborhoods that could see housing development.
And what the agreement basically says is that any housing development that comes up out of this must have the approval from those two neighborhood organizations. If anything happens in that redevelopment area and happens as it relates to housing, they get to come to the table, and you need to reach agreement with them in order for that to happen, to make sure that these folks don't feel that they are not disenfranchised out of their neighborhood.
So you all know that this year we decided to spend our entire season dissecting the intersection of race and housing, which of course has meant taking a pretty critical look at the deeply destructive patterns of segregation in St. Louis. And listening this year, you might have thought to yourself, sheesh, they talk a lot about the problems.
And, I mean, that's true, we do. But that's not the total picture of what's going on in our region, because Adolphus Pruitt isn't alone. There is definitely a robust conversation among some circles about the daunting challenges tied to the segregation in the St. Louis region.
There's also a lot of chatter about solutions. And with our season winding down, we decided to dedicate the rest of this show to listening to a man who's been leading a team of some of the smartest people in St. Louis with the goal of dismantling divides and creating a new path forward.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
You guys have gotten to know a bunch of people concerned with, affected by, and even perpetrating the intense system of segregation in St. Louis. So it's kind of weird that until now, this season, we haven't introduced you to this guy.
Hi, my name is Jason Purnell. I've been stirring up trouble for the last couple of years.
Yeah, how you been doing that?
Bringing people's attention to the disparities that continue to shape outcomes here in St. Louis.
And you do that because you are a...
I am a professor.
Complete the sentence.
Do you mind mentioning you're a professor of?
I am a professor. I'm an associate professor at the Brown School at Washington University in St. Louis. I teach in both the public health and social work programs.
Awesome.
Jason is pretty well known for a research effort he led a couple years back about racial disparities in health outcomes.
The report that resulted from that research, known simply from its title, For the Sake of All, is cited pretty often from regular folks around town to public officials. It detailed how segregation is taking years off of residents' lives and how vastly different life expectancies are between zip codes, the largest of which is more than 30 years.
And it's pretty impossible not to see the links between that body of work and this latest report Jason has helped shepherd about housing segregation.
I think when people asked me over and over again what was surprising to you in the data that was uncovered in that original report, it wasn't the health outcomes. I expected the health disparities. The extent to which segregation was still very much with us. As I've started saying, it's not grainy black and white newsreel footage.
Yep.
It's right here, right now, and it's still impacting outcomes. And it's kind of this central organizing factor because of all the things that spin off of where you live. It's your access to education. It's your access to social networks and social support. It's your access to transportation, services, amenities, doctor's offices, everything that flows from where you live. And then you start to uncover this history of just truly nefariously creative people.
Yeah.
Coming up with every tool in the toolbox.
That is a great phrase, nefariously creative.
Yeah.
It's just staggering, and it's infuriating.
Now, Jason's not a housing expert, so he got a lot of help.
Yeah, in fact, he's careful to share the credit with the dozens of activists, organizations, and legal scholars who worked for months putting this together.
And you guys have definitely heard these names during our season. Arch City Defenders, the Metropolitan St. Louis Equal Housing Commission, or EHOC, and Richard Rothstein.
Among a lot of other people.
Yes.
The list is long.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one thing that became clear, Jason says, is that the report needed to address both the past and the future.
And that meant coming to grips with St. Louis's particular place in history as it relates to race.
Because St. Louis was such an early stop in that first wave of the Great Migration, our particular form of racism had time to sort of gestate, and it had time to harden, and it had time to become more virulent. So that movement out of the South that starts around 1915, it's not surprising when you place it in that context that in 1916 they're voting on a racial zoning ordinance
right.
mm-hmm.
for
yeah.
the city of St. Mm-hmm. Louis, and that in 1917 they're having the massacres in East St. Louis, and in the 1920s restrictive deed covenants, and then on and on and on. Trapping people without opportunity. So, you know, there's a line in the report that it's psychological separation just as much as it is physical separation. Mm-hmm. It's an inability to internalize the humanity of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the surest way to cause destruction. It doesn't take a long trip through history to see that when we no longer see people as human, we can justify doing all manner of things.
In a lot of ways, the segregation report, officially titled Dismantling the Divide, is meant to counter those forces. It prescribes nearly a dozen recommendations to tip the St. Louis region toward more equity in housing opportunities and access.
You already heard about one of those solutions at the top of the episode, CBAs. And some of you diehard listeners may remember us talking in a previous show about a source of income protection for Section 8 tenants.
As of now, that doesn't exist for people who live in St. Louis County, which means landlords can legally discriminate against them for having a housing voucher.
Other recommendations include reforming tax incentive programs and boosting tenant protections in order to reduce evictions and illegal lockouts.
So the recommendations were really vetted with the experts who are doing the work in the field
mm-hmm.
around equal housing and housing discrimination and equitable development. So I actually think that is the superior model even to the first report.
So if you're home thinking, cool, a report, recommendations. Is anything going to happen, though?
Jason says, yeah, something is definitely going to happen because things are already starting to happen.
One of the biggest shifts, in fact, came this summer, just a couple months after the segregation report's release.
Are we ready?
Ready.
All right.
A handful of public officials called reporters together to make an announcement.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning. Earlier today, I signed an executive order establishing a task force charged with developing recommendations for establishment of a housing trust fund in St. Louis County.
This is St. Louis County Executive Steve Stanger at the press conference.
The impetus for this action is based on a self-evident truth that every St. Louis County resident deserves a decent and affordable place to call home. This task force will be responsible for identifying the funding priorities and potential revenue sources for a housing trust fund, while also outlining the appropriate governance and administrative framework to ensure the fund helps meet the housing needs of the largest number of county residents.
Okay, we know that was a mouthful, so let's break it down.
Basically, St. Louis County officials have decided they're going to set up a specific pot of local money, a trust fund, to better meet the needs of residents struggling to find, keep, and maintain safe, affordable, and habitable housing.
Which Stanger points out is not a very unique issue.
There is not a single state, county, or metropolitan area in the entire country where a full-time worker earning the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour can afford a decent two-bedroom apartment. This is quite simply an unacceptable situation.
Hundreds of communities around the country have turned to housing trust funds to help fill gaps in funding that traditionally came from state and federal governments.
You know, we've had multiple reports that have talked about this, and it just is time. You know, we can all say, oh, why didn't we do it earlier, or why didn't our community step forward and do this earlier? But, you know, I think we're wasting time saying that.
In fact, the county is trailing others in the region. The city of St. Louis already has a housing trust fund. But that, of course, doesn't cover the thousands of people who don't live in the region's urban core.
Adrian Bracey, CEO of the YWCA Metro St. Louis, says the Housing Trust Fund is a critical need. She's co-chairing the task force along with Chris Kraemeyer of Beyond Housing, who's been on our show a couple times.
This task force gives us an opportunity to truly dig deep, to understand the underlying issues, and then craft a delivery system to truly make a change in the housing situation for families in St. Louis County. I look forward to working with the extremely talented and experienced members of the task force and staff of St. Louis County to craft the most effective recommendations for the county executive. Thank you.
So like we said earlier, the announcement came this summer. Since then, the task force has had a few meetings and started soliciting feedback from county residents about things they'd like to see the fund used for.
Because remember, local funds equals local control.
In theory.
In theory.
Yeah.
And the group is expected to have an update on their efforts early next year.
But Jason says that's not the only recommended solution in the report that's gotten some attention. The city of St. Louis has poured more money into its own housing trust fund.
And housing advocates have teamed with local bankers to explore a fund that would subsidize lending in areas where it's difficult for people to get financing. Kind of like a reversal, if you will, of redlining.
Jason says it's imperative that progress like this continues to ripple out.
I think people were kind of waiting for this report.
And sure, many of the proposed solutions are pretty logical and what you might expect from a report like this.
They're built on models that are already in use, maybe just not here. But there was one recommendation that's just different enough from the others that we had to ask Jason about.
And I took a lot of hope from, I read this article in the New York Times about this movement that's afoot called co-housing.
We're going to talk about that.
We are?
Yes.
Cool. So should I stop talking about it?
No, please go on. No. We'll just use it as a transition. just let you in our brain.
So when we left off, we promised we'd get into a solution in the segregation report that was not quite like the others.
Jason was eager to talk about it. But first, we had to get through this title he has for it, which is, it's a mouthful.
Okay, establish consciously inclusive communities to unite neighbors in focused action to make their communities welcoming and accessible in terms of income and racial and ethnic diversity to build ties that support human development and connection.
Yes.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? You know, that's a fair question because we still have to imagine it. But we can't get there until we make that our goal, until that's part of the intention. But what I had in mind was restrictive covenants, very often sponsored by the church on the corner, the university, the civic organization in town, are these agreements where neighbors are contractually obligating themselves never to sell their homes to African Americans. What if we flip that on its head? Not in a sort of legalistic sense, but in a sense where neighbors are coming together and they're saying, this is how we want to define the character of this community. And we want to define it as a place that has racial and ethnic diversity and socioeconomic diversity. Mm-hmm. That's a goal of ours. It really is an open question. What does that begin to look like? Now, I have some ideas. You'd need cooperation from developers. You'd need cooperation from the real estate industry. You would need some legal infrastructure at the municipal level that allows for a more inclusive sort of development.
A good place to start, Jason says, would be inclusionary zoning. That's a practice in some cities where affordable housing is tied more directly into new housing development.
That's not building some new high-rise public housing development, which we know is a failed strategy. It's saying in an area where there is some economic opportunity, we're going to set aside a certain proportion of the housing to be affordable housing. Mm-hmm. There are other sensible, innovative, creative. So what if that creativity is not nefarious creativity, but actually productive creativity?
Can you see something like that in St. Louis?
I can. There are already these pockets of diversity in St. Louis that need to be protected, and they're only going to be protected if people are making conscious choices to protect them.
According to the New York Times, which who doesn't trust the New York Times?
Some people.
I can think of one.
You walk right into that. Maybe some of you really listening. Who knows?
We better get back on track now. Jason found out about this idea in the New York Times. It's where he got it from. And according to the New York Times, we digress, there are 165 co-housing communities in the U.S. right now, and 140 are in the planning stage, according to the New York Times.
Jason knows people are skeptical this idea would ever take off. In fact, he jokes that this recommendation is the one the other partners let him put into
put
the report.
How do you put air quotes?
How do you oversound? But I'm doing it right now. Yeah. Let him put into the report.
Because, I mean, come on. It could seem a little, I'm just saying this, it could seem a little Pollyannish to think that it could happen here. I mean, a big chunk of this report is about how many times throughout the years St. Louis has chosen to embrace racism and segregation.
But Jason believes there is fertile ground to plant the seeds for a co-housing inclusive community in the St. Louis region.
This notion that in this alienated postmodernist moment that we live in, people want to create community. They want to live with each other in community. And folks are buying houses in proximity to one another and setting aside some common space where they have meals together, they decide what the rules of the community are going to be. And it's multi-generational. And there was a part of that article where they said some of these co-housing developments have added affordable housing. And it hasn't hurt their property values, which is everybody's big...
It's like the go-to whenever...
Right.
Yeah.
It's their big fear that if we have more affordable options, there goes the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That's not what's happening. And I think there's nothing inevitable about that happening if you consciously create the supports and infrastructure to have truly inclusive housing arrangements. And it's not to say it's going to happen without any friction or conflict, or we're still humans. Mm-hmm. But we can certainly come to a more sensible way of trying to distribute opportunities and resources.
It's worth keeping in mind that though there's certainly potential for some or all of the ideas listed out in the report to make a dent in segregation in St. Louis. But people aren't naive about the hurdles in front of these solutions.
Which brings us back to Adolphus Pruitt, the head of the local NAACP, who pushed for that community benefits agreement after the summer of sewage. He says,
oh, God.
Too much?
Too much.
Anyway, Adolphus says agreements like the one he helped organize with MSD and in Midtown St. Louis have to respect the financial pressures facing developers and organizations. And you can't take a one-size-fits-all approach to any of this.
CBAs are as different as snowflakes.
Mm-hmm.
And they said no two snowflakes are alike, no two CBAs are alike, and they should not be.
Yet, it's in this flexibility that Pruitt sees potential. For example, CBAs don't have to be tied to geography. So, for example, development in one part of the city could be tapped to spur development in another part of the city that's seen decades of disinvestment.
Hey, if you're going to develop downtown St. Louis, you can do that. But I can use your help over here in North St. Louis or in Wellston. Can you help me over here? Mm-hmm. And that I do like.
And Pruitt says because there are examples of CBAs already working in the St. Louis region, there's a certain kind of cultural infrastructure that's being built to broker similar deals in the future.
The hope is not only in the document itself. The hope is also in the process leading to a positive outcome. A positive outcome that everybody continues to invest in and able to coalesce in a positive way. That is the greatest outcome out of all of these agreements.
Do I think that we will be a completely changed region in 10 years? No. I think there is a sense in which you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Mm-hmm.
You can't unknow some of this. And people will no longer be able to say, I didn't know that. It's possible to know that. It's possible to know not just about our history of segregation, but the ways in which we continue to maintain segregation in St. Louis. And I think you're going to see more people showing up. And standing up, and a new generation of leadership coming to the fore, asking different questions. I'm also hopeful that you begin to see organizing and advocacy that isn't just, I tend to err on the side of persuasion, but my activist friends talk more about demands and power. But to be able to have residents who are organized enough to exert some influence in places of power, I think the combination of those bodes well. And there is so much that can be done at the local level, in part because things at the federal level are so broken. It's cities who are really kind of innovating. Mm. And I think that is a reason to be hopeful.
There are a lot of recommendations in the report that Jason Purnell helped lead. And if you want to read the entire report, we're going to post a link to it at our website, which is welivehere.show. welivehere.show. So go there and check out the entire report.
Yes. Also, we need to say thank you to our colleague, Ashley Listenby. She let us use some of the tape that she had gathered at that press conference about the Affordable Housing Trust Fund this past summer.
Next time on We Live Here.
Oh, yeah, it was really bad. Because I had four back surgeries. And then all of a sudden you had to move on in 24 hours. That was real bad on me. And then I had to find people to come and help me move out and stuff. And then they put me over in the next apartment over. And dead roaches, but that cleaned it up and everything because I had to find somewhere to stay. And then I moved it over there. And then found out you had to leave out again. Hair falling out, everything. I was really stressed about that.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Robert Peterson, Director of Radio Programming. He's our boss. And from St. Louis Public Radio.
I forgot what we were supposed to say next. My God, it's been a long season, guys.
Back away slowly.
From the microphones.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX.
This is We Live Here.
I like that.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.